Good afternoon. Welcome to the Democracy Forum. This is the ninth program in our series this year to broadcast at this time on the third Friday of each month. We're featuring topics in Maine's participatory democracy, encouraging citizens to take an active role in government and politics. This program is a project of the League of Women Voters Down East, produced in cooperation with WERU-FM. As we do at this time every year, our conversation today is about what's on your ballot. We'll talk about the two ballot questions that will appear on the November 4th state ballot in Maine. Those ballots are actually now available for absentee voting. But how does the citizen initiative process work in Maine? What are the two ballot questions this year? What will the new laws do if passed? What are the proponents saying? What are the opponents saying? Who's funding the campaigns, et cetera? In the interest of transparency and full disclosure, the League of Women Voters has endorsed a no vote on question one and a yes vote on question two. But our guests today are not speaking for the League. The opinions expressed are their own. This is not a show about what the League thinks. It's a show to help you figure out what you should think. The show is pre-recorded on October 17th, 2025. Your comments to news@weru.org will be welcome. Please put Democracy Forum in the subject line. This is Ann Luther from the League of Women Voters. I'll be your host for the Democracy Forum. Let me introduce our guests. Mark Brewer is the professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of Maine. Welcome back, Mark.
Happy to be here.
Amy Freed is professor emerita of political science at the University of Maine. Welcome back, Amy.
Great to be here, Ann.
And then Mike Shepard, who's also been on the show before, is the political editor at the Bangor Daily News. Thanks for being with us today, Mike.
Great to be back and with my two former professors.
Yeah, isn't that funny? All right, so let's get started. And Mark, maybe I'll ask you first. Election Day is November 4th. Early voting is already underway. The state ballot has just two questions. Can you tell the listeners what the two questions are?
Well, the first question in the order is determined by random draw. So the first question has to do with a lot of things regarding voting. Most people refer to it as a voter ID question, but there's a whole lot of other stuff in there as well: absentee voting, early voting, voter drop boxes. But it's voting stuff. And then question two has to do with a mechanism in which someone can petition a court to take firearms away from someone who is deemed a danger to themselves or to others.
Also known as a red flag.
Red flag, yes.
All right, so let's start out the show by just taking each of those two questions one at a time. We'll start with question one. And I mean, maybe I could ask one of you to actually just read the question. Mike?
I do have it in front of me. So do you want to change Maine election laws to eliminate 2 days of absentee voting, prohibit requests for absentee ballots by phone or family members, end ongoing absentee voter status for seniors and people with disabilities, ban prepaid postage on absentee ballot return envelopes, limit the number of drop boxes, require voters to show certain photo ID before voting, and make other changes to our elections? It's a long question, but it does encompass all the things in this referendum.
So what would the new law do if passed, Mike?
Yeah, essentially the headline of this is voter ID. And that's a relatively straightforward concept that I think most people understand. But there is a lot more in this question, and I think that's where this campaign kind of gets going. You have elements that bolster the photo ID part, including there's an exception for people with religious exemptions, right? You have to present proof of a photo ID for absentee voting. It requires the Secretary of State to provide free of photo ID cards to people without a driver's license. But it's the absentee ballot limits, I think, that really are the sort of the thing here to look at, prohibiting requesting an absentee ballot by phone or on behalf of a family member, limiting the number of election drop boxes in a municipality to one, which only goes after drop boxes in Portland and Orono, where the university has one. So Portland and Orono are also two of the most progressive, you know, Democratic voting places in the state. And there are some other little tweaks in here as well, like mandating a bipartisan team of election officials go and collect the ballots from drop boxes. Most places, right, the town clerk just goes and gets the ballots at the end of the day. So that is really like, I'm not sure how that will be administered in a lot of these places, but that's another, you know, kind of side effect of the law that town clerks are looking at for sure.
Amy, anything you want to add to that?
Well, I'd note that about 85% of the provisions involve absentee ballots. And even though the title is photo ID, and when the petitions that were circulated to qualify the ballot said photo ID, the underlying legislation that was always, you know, the when it was being circulated was 85% absentee ballot restrictions.
Mm-hmm. Mark, anything you want to add to what the law would do?
I think the one other thing that I don't think has been mentioned yet is that under current Maine law, senior citizens and people with certain disabilities can qualify, apply for an absentee ballot once and then get that ballot continuously over the years. This legislation would end that provision. And it also would make sending back absentee ballots a little bit more difficult. It would add the second envelope. People would have to fill out an unsworn affidavit on it. This is done in other states, and the data on that show that that results in more absentee ballots being challenged and ultimately tossed out because people fill those out improperly. So I really do want to, you know, both Mike and Amy have said this, but I think it's worth repeating that this is about far more than showing voter ID. There is a lot of stuff in here that would have, taken together, would have a pretty dramatic impact on how we conduct Maine elections.
Yeah. Amy.
I'd also add regarding the photo ID part that tribal IDs and student IDs could not be used. And that would also have an impact on certain voters. And, you know, even when we think about seniors or people with disabilities, some of them, maybe most of them, had current driver's licenses at one point when they were driving, but no longer do. So they wouldn't have a current driver's license to provide when they make an absentee ballot request.
Yeah. If I can just shift it a little bit, Mike, how did this question come to be on the ballot? Because these photo ID petitions have circulated before. This is the first one that actually qualified.
Yeah, I mean, and voter ID has been a perennial bill, a perennial Republican bill in the legislature. This one is obviously much more encompassing, and that it was the product of a referendum push. Really, one of the only referendum pushes in recent years by Republicans. It's led by the Dinner Table PAC, which is fronted by Laurel Libby and the state representative from Auburn, who has become one of the more well known Republicans in state politics over the past year. Of course, with the governor's battle with President Trump and the sort of fallout from there, getting censured and things like that. So this is really their baby. We talked a lot about what's in this referendum, and I think that the thing to look at here is that voter ID taken it by itself, right, is quite popular. There are national polls that have it up at 65%. You know, it's not supported by the League of Women Voters certainly, or many Democratic officials, but it is very popular with people out there. Now, all the other stuff, right? Absentee voting, Maine's sort of liberal system of absentee voting is also quite popular. So the campaigns here, right, are sort of focusing on two different things, right? The Republican side of this campaign is talking almost exclusively about the voter ID stuff and trying to downplay the rest of it, while the Democratic, you know, the Democratic committee that's been put together to fight this initiative, right? You know, it's called Save Absentee Voting. So it's all about this juxtaposition is really what this campaign is all about, and I think that makes the politics of this interesting, and the odd election year timing of it makes it a little odd in more ways than one. So that's how we got here.
Amy or Mike, want to add to that? How did this question get on the ballot?
No, I mean, obviously the process requires a gathering of a certain number of signatures. I believe it's 10% of the turnout in the most recent gubernatorial election. So that's the mechanics of it. The other thing, I think Mike was alluding to this when he was talking about the odd nature of this. generally, if you want to have a high turnout for your ballot initiative, you want to schedule it during, at least during an even year, if not a presidential even year. This is in an off year cycle, which I think is done intentionally, right? I think Republicans did this intentionally, thinking that maybe lower turnout might benefit them on this question. I don't know if that question's been asked to Libby or Alex Titcomb, but I would suspect that would be the case.
What do you think, Amy? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with that. And I also point out, related to Mike's point, that what the referendum is about showed up in the process of writing the ballot question. So once, you know, that's part of the process too. The Secretary of State will write a proposed ballot question. There's a public comment period on that. And also that can be challenged once that's finalized. And the proponents of question one, the yes on one side, did challenge that language because she put in a number of the provisions that have to do with absentee voting. And actually, I'll just say here that I had a little bit of involvement in this because I co-wrote an amicus brief arguing that those should be included because those were important elements of the legislation, what the referendum would actually do. But in that law case, in the case challenging it, the yes on one side said that, you know, they proposed language, which would basically be photo ID. It was like, do you want to adopt photo ID for voters and make other changes? They didn't want any of the other items in there. So all along, it really has been a battle over defining what the referendum is about.
And I mean, you touched on this already, Mike, a little bit, like what are the proponents saying? What are the opponents saying? But just expound on that a little bit. Like, how are these campaigns shaping up in terms of their messaging?
Yeah, I mean, that is essentially it. I could expound more, but they are being pretty careful on the yes side to not point to, you know, widespread voter fraud or anything like that. You know, they haven't quite mirrored, right, the sort of the President Trump's sort of line on this. And, you know, although they're, you know, that is sort of certainly part of where their base is on this issue. So they've been pretty careful on that, kind of couching it as more of a check, trying to keep that coalition as wide as possible. I will also mention too that up front, this effort got a big boost from Leonard Leo, right? This got on the ballot in part because his sort of political network gave them a lot of money. Interestingly enough, they're not really raising any money right now. I think they raised about $11,000 in the latest 3-month fundraising period. It's not a good sign for the yes side of any referendum. If you're prosecuting a case for a referendum, you gotta be out there pushing it, and they just really don't have much. I will say that behind the scenes, right, a lot of Republicans kind of that I talked to have griped a lot about this question. If they had just given us a clean question, right, we think that 60 to 70% of the state would go for a clean voter ID question, but they've gummed it up. A lot of these same people are also publicly supporting the referendum, but you know, it's become, I think, kind of a base thing. And the Democrats on the save Maine absentee voting group is what it's called. I mean, they've raised $1.3 million over the course of their campaign, so they have a lot going on, a lot of canvassing candidates, gubernatorial candidates, Senate candidates. Graham Plattner has been out there canvassing on this, so it's become a big sort of infrastructure building thing for Democrats as they look to kind of harness this the anti-Trump energy that's out there on their side ahead of 2026. So I think you're seeing this campaign bleed into a lot of other campaigns, and I think that's also one of the interesting things about this odd year timing.
So we're coming into the final weeks before the election. Mark, what are you expecting to see as the campaigns run to a close?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, as Mike points out, there is a little bit of a resource disparity right now, it would seem. And so that generally would put the advantage on the no on one side, if that disparity holds. But I think big picture, we're going to see each side try and hammer home their message. And their message is, as you know, we've kind of alluded to a couple of times, is if you're on the yes on one side, for you, this is all about election security, right? You're trying to convince Mainers that really all this is a, it's very simple. We want to secure our elections. You have to show an ID to do all kinds of things. Why shouldn't you have to show one to vote? If you're on the no on one side, it's all about voter suppression, right? It's like, this is not really election security. This is a measure that is being pitched as election security, but really is a mechanism to make it more difficult for certain groups of Mainers to vote, plain and simple. And I think that's what each side is really going to try and hammer home as we get closer to Election Day and mobilize as many people in support of their side as they can.
All right, let me take a station break, then we'll turn to question two. Listeners, you're tuned to the Democracy Forum on WERU-FM. This is Ann Luther of the League of Women Voters of Maine. Our topic today is what's on your ballot. Our guests this afternoon are Amy Fried, Professor Emerita of Political Science at the University of Maine, Mike Shepard, Political Editor at the Bangor Daily News, and Mark Brewer, Professor and Chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of Maine. This program was recorded on October 17th. No listener calls are being taken on the show. So to question two, let's do the same battery of questions. Amy, you've got the language right there for question two?
Yes, I do. It's titled An Act to Protect Maine Communities by Enacting the Extreme Risk Protection Order Act. And the question reads, do you want to allow courts to temporarily prohibit a person from having dangerous weapons if law enforcement, family, or household members show that the person poses a significant danger of causing physical injury to themselves or others?
So, Mark, what would this question do if it passed?
Well, I think this one's a little more complicated than question one, even though maybe you could argue there's less in it. And that complication could be the fact that I have less expertise on this matter. But it does seem to me that's a little more complicated. But it would, I mean, currently, I guess we should back up. Currently, Maine has in place a yellow flag law that allows mechanisms for guns, I suppose other weapons as well, to be taken away from people if there is sufficient cause shown. This law, or this act, if it was passed, would add a so-called red flag law to the yellow flag law that's in place. So they would both be on the books, which is a little bit confusing in and of itself. But this would expand the number of people who could initiate the process and would make it easier for courts to actually put the protection order in place, among some other details. But I think those are the two biggest changes.
You want to elaborate on that a little, Mike?
Yeah, I would explain it like this. I think you have to explain the yellow flag law that we have in effect before you kind of get to what the red flag law would change. So we came up with a pretty novel law, right? In 2019, Governor Mills, former Attorney General Mike Carpenter, who's in the Maine Senate, Republicans, the Sportsmen's Alliance of Maine, this was really a grand bargain. And it essentially allowed police to trigger this process, right? You call them, they determine that someone is a danger to themselves or others. They take that person for a mental health screening. And then, you know, a judge, and after that, a judge is able to initiate the order. The order under the red flag law is the same order. Nothing really changes on that front at the back end. This just allows families or anyone else really to just go right to court themselves, right? Skip that whole sort of law enforcement evaluation step. So this is not, you know, as Mark said, this is not exactly replacing the yellow flag order. I actually think that there's a chance that the yellow flag law still gets used more potentially than a red flag law would here. So it's a lot less of it's a lot harder to kind of suss out the real world consequences of this if Maine didn't have any of these laws in place, for instance. I think the thing to know about the yellow flag law is that it was not used very much, up until the Lewiston shooting. It's been expanded in a lot of ways since then. There's a virtual program now for these mental health evaluations that is a lot easier for hospitals to swallow because, you know, it's a difficult process to physically bring someone who may be disturbed, you know, into a hospital setting, right? So that's made it a lot easier. It's been used hundreds and hundreds of times. since Lewiston, it seems to be working much better than it certainly was before then. And there was everything out of the Lewiston shooting that you know, the complications around this law. So those have been ironed out. I think it's worth noting, too, that Massachusetts over a period of a few years, I think, used their red flag law something like 20 times. So, again, I think this is it's a lot more nuanced of a conversation around this issue. The players on this are kind of the same ones you see on a lot of these gun issues, right? The Maine Gun Safety Coalition is for it. The Sportsman's Alliance of Maine and the NRA is against it. But there are a lot of little layers in there as well. Governor Mills opposes the question because she negotiated this yellow flag law and thinks it's working well. So there's a lot of nuance here. There's not much of a campaign going on around it. Not a ton of money being spent, much more by the yes side than on the no side. I think in keeping with that, I think probably the yes side is favored at this point, but the surrogates and the people who are out there on this, including the Maine State Police, a lieutenant of the Maine State Police was just at a public event, opposing this question yesterday and was at one last week up here in Bangor. So, it's a little more nuanced than question one, but, it's still a really interesting question, and it will be a fun one to kind of watch to see how towns go on election night.
Amy?
Yeah, and I'm no expert on gun laws in general, but I do know that even before there was a yellow flag law in Maine, under certain circumstances, guns were supposed to be removed from certain people. And that was under the Federal Violence Against Women Act. But there were a lot of differences in terms of how states did this. Frankly, I only know this because I had a student who did a big research project on this at one point. But in any case, like in Massachusetts, the police would come to someone's door and take away the guns and put them in some kind of gun locker at the police department. While in Maine, somebody could say, well, I'm the family member, I'm just going to store them in my house, you know, which was obviously a less secure mechanism. And we do know, like, women who are killed in Maine, as in, I think, every state, the primary people who kill them or shoot them are men that they were married to, still married to, boyfriends, former boyfriends. So, you know, those were the kinds of circumstances specifically. You know, there have been things, it's continuing to build on that and expand it. One thing that Mike mentioned about the lack of money and the lack of a campaign that I think, and this is going into the politics of this a little bit, I think what this means is that you won't have as many people turning out simply to vote on a gun measure, which in the past in Maine, I think really has happened, whether you're talking about bear baiting or waiting periods. There have been instances where measures on the ballot pulled out a lot of hunters, a lot of conservative voters. So without this, it's a little bit of a different electorate, than if there was a really active competitive campaign.
Why do you think that is?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know anything about the campaign to put it on the ballot. In some ways, you'd have to ask them. I think if they were really running ads and doing a lot of work, then you would have a lot going on the other side as well. But yeah, without a really active yes on two campaign, you don't have a really active no campaign. I think that's probably good for no on one, because you're not pulling out, you know, a lot of Republican voters. But, you know, all of this is kind of conjecture based on other things, you know, other knowledge that I have.
Mark or Mike, do you have a thought on why the usual gun rights side has not been as active on this as they have been on previous ballot questions relating to gun rights?
I think it's actually both sides have not been as active on this. The big funders on the yes side of this question, for instance, are not every town for gun safety, right? Or the ones you see in states where they're having these big, you know, these big gun referendums, right? These are more progressive groups like the Global Impact Social Welfare Fund, which is a kind of a big sort of democratic, you know, progressive kind of money machine. I think on that side, well, I'll just take the side separately. I think on that side, Maine's yellow flag law sort of took a little bit of heat out of this question, right? This is not a question between no red flag law or a red flag law, right? We have a middle ground version of a red flag law that's being used an awful lot. And we have the red flag law that would go on top of that. So I think it's just an
incremental change, not a day and night change.
Yeah, I think that a campaign like this needs high stakes to attract a lot of attention and national funding. So I think that on that side, it's just a little bit difficult to get that traction going. On the gun rights side, the groups are out there. I mean, this is what the Sportsman's Alliance of Maine is doing right now. You know, going kind of community by community and trying to get the word out there and through surrogates and really amplifying the governor's op-eds and things like this. But I just don't think that the Republicans I've talked to, you know, similar to the one side, they're not very optimistic. And I think it's because this campaign's sort of being run in a vacuum, right? And I think sometimes you get into these referendum battles, it's easier being the yes side than to prosecute the no side. So I don't think it's not a campaign that's fully hopeless on the no side. I just think that there's just not a lot of fundraising momentum out there this year for that. And you're seeing them just kind of do more kind of grass tops, top level surrogate stuff, do events, hope to bring it home. But this is certainly not like past gun referendums we've had, right? 2014 Bear Baiting, right. Which is not a gun referendum, but essentially was, right, in the middle of a good Republican election year, and then in 2016, right, which was not a bad year for Democrats nationally, but Maine has just not been friendly to these gun control referendums in the past. So I think this one is just a little bit lower stakes on both sides. Even if it passes, it's not a huge, huge, huge change. So I wouldn't really see it, you know, on election day as a huge win for the national gun control movement if this passes in Maine. I think it's very much, you know, an incremental step and kind of unique to Maine's politics right now.
So, I mean, just to encapsulate, what is the yes side saying about why this should pass? And what is the no side saying about why it shouldn't pass?
Yeah. Go ahead. I'm happy. Yeah.
Go ahead, Amy.
Well, I mean, I think the yes side is saying that family members should have the ability when they see something going on to trigger this process. I mean, I think that's really the main argument. They see something happening and they should be able to go to a court, and perhaps they've tried with the police, I don't know, and didn't feel like it was working, you know, in some situations. So they need to have a direct, family members need to have a direct way to do it. And the opposition is focused on what I've mostly heard people talk about is lack of due process, because there's a hearing that the court has to hold, but it's within 14 days. So in that time period, someone would lose access to their guns.
So I mean,
maybe there's other issues too, but that's mostly what I've heard.
Well, one other addition, I guess, on the no side is, and Mike alluded to this earlier, is just, you know, the argument that it's simply not necessary, right? That the current yellow flag laws that's been tweaked in the aftermath of Lewiston is being used. It's working. That's the primary argument that the governor's making, right, is that we don't need this because what we have is working. Why go and add something we don't need when what we have is working quite well? So that's another argument here.
Yeah. What about the due process claim, Mike?
I think that it's all a matter of perspective, right? I think that what you would hear from the no side on this question is a family member could have a lot of reasons, right, for taking someone to court. Might be good reasons, might be bad reasons, and that the current system allows the mental health evaluation, right, and the police to sort of serve a check on any sort of malfeasance or, you know, or sort of nuisance complaints that might come into the process, right? When you allow them to go right to a judge, something else could happen, right? And we see a lot of temporary restraining orders, right, granted in our court system that end up being thrown out once the case sort of gets there. So the judge is kind of err generally on the side of granting a protection order, right, when someone comes in. I mean, obviously we see it all the time, and just the court documents that we look at here at the paper every day. So that's the argument. I think that on the yes side, it's just, well, why shouldn't families have this option too? Right. They've talked a lot about the Lewiston shooting. I think that, they've had one of the members of that commission, former Department of Public Safety Commissioner Ann Jordan, has been out there on their side on this. I don't see a lot of evidence in the Lewiston case, right, that the family would have gone straight to a judge. I think they were very much, I mean, I think everyone could go back and read the reporting that was done and the commission report on the shooting. And I think that this family was trying to address this and keeping it very much in the family, I think, trying to make sure that the eventual shooter, Robert Card, didn't have access to guns. Fortunately, it didn't work that way, of course. But I think that you see the yes side sort of picking apart the yellow flag law a little bit retrospectively and saying just that family should have this option. So I think it's very much what, I think it's very much what Mark and Amy said.
Go ahead, Amy.
Unlike Mike, I haven't read that report, but I did see a quote from the spokesperson for Yes on One, who said the experiment, meaning the yellow flag law, failed in Lewiston, and the gunman's family knew he was dangerous and repeatedly warned law enforcement. So that's their presentation of it. In a way, I think it's interesting that the no sides in both of these referenda, some of the argument is we don't need this. We don't have a problem. There's not a big problem with voter fraud. There's not a big problem with our gun laws now because we have the yellow flag law.
You're tuned to the Democracy Forum on WERU FM. This is Ann Luther from the League of Women Voters of Maine. Our guests this afternoon are Mike Shepard, political editor of the Bangor Daily News, Mark Brewer, professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of Maine, and Amy Fried, professor emerita of political science, also at the University of Maine. Our topic today is What's on Your Ballot? The show was pre-recorded. Send your comments or questions to news@weru.org. Please put Democracy Forum in the subject line. So we were just wrapping up our conversation on question two, and Amy, go ahead, finish your thought there.
Yeah, I mean, it is the same kind of argument from both no sides. We don't need these provisions. And a lot of times voters will be, why should I really do this? Unless there's a good reason to do it and they feel very strongly about it, it's pretty easy to say let's keep what we have.
And Mark, isn't there sort of a predisposition among voters to vote no? Like, doesn't the yes side have a little hurdle to overcome?
Yeah, generally, it's not always the case. I mean, I think as Mike pointed out earlier, if question one were just simply a voter ID question and it was just that, this might not apply. But generally, yes, it is much easier to defend the status quo than something new. So that's definitely an issue here. I would want to circle back maybe one more thing on the politics of question two is we talked about how the red flag law would be seen as an incremental change and maybe it's relatively low stakes. But in the past, a group like the NRA has fought everything, right? Whether it's incremental, low stakes, they fought it tooth and nail. And the fact that they're not really doing that here might be indicative of, some weakening of the NRA in the last decade or so. The NRA is still powerful, but it's not maybe what it used to be. And I think maybe the lack of effort here on their part on this question is indicative of that. Because before, it didn't matter how small the change was, they fought it. They're not doing that here, at least not so far. And I think that's important, and not necessarily on this question, but bigger picture it is.
Yeah. Any other thoughts on question two? Otherwise, I want to just ask a bigger, broader question about the referendum process. But final thoughts on question two? Okay, hearing none. Let's just give our listeners a little civics lesson. Like, how do ballot questions work in Maine? And how do we even get this clause in our Constitution? You want to go first, Mike?
Yeah, I love this question because I love the referendum process as a political historian, I guess, at this point. I'm 34 and I feel like I've been through a lot of the history here already. So this was a progressive era reform, right? And it was done in a lot of states. So this has been in the Constitution since, I believe, 1908. Don't quote me on that. I believe that's true. 1909 was when we enacted it. And interestingly enough, I mean, this really was barely used, right? 1911, we got one, and then the next one was in 1923. So it was really very sparingly used. And this has really been much more of a modern phenomenon in our politics. So there have been several just in the past, let's say the last 10 years, right? And I don't have that count off the top of my head. Interestingly enough, more have failed than have passed. I think the record is 38 to 36 from my quick read of the law library summary of all this. So there is, I think, and I wanted to return to this point because since we were talking about it, that predisposition to say no. I do think that happens in a lot of cases, right? The voter necessarily, right, has to be convinced that there's a problem worth solving. And sometimes these campaigns that are run in sort of a vacuum, right? I think last year we had a great example of one in the state flag debate, right? That there was no organized campaign really on either side of that. It was more of an esoteric idea, right? What does this thing mean to you? And why should we throw out the current flag and replace it with something that graphic designers like a lot more because it's cleaner and maybe a little more symbolic, right, of how Maine, you know, how Maine looks right now. And that was shot down by the voters pretty unceremoniously. And the polling in the run-up to the election really showed that. I mean, Republicans were very cold to it. Democrats were cool on it. And they couldn't end up building the state flag, couldn't end up building the coalition it needed to pass. And you see this in a lot of the other referendums that we've talked about, right? I think that there was a fatal flaw in the background check referendum in 2016, and what the Sportsmen's Alliance and the NRA really picked apart was not the background check system as a whole, but it was this idea that you'd have to take your best friend or your cousin to a dealer to do a background check if they just wanted to take your gun and go hunting with it, even though you know they're a good guy. There are often like little holes you can poke in these questions that make people say, well, if we were doing this a different way, maybe, but I don't think this is the best way to do it. So I think that all these referendums are different. They're all run under different circumstances in different eras, but I think you see a common theme with some of these questions, and they're clashing a little bit here, right? Because the campaigns are not huge, but you see kind of conflicting markers here that sort of make me favor both yes sides of this debate, maybe a little more so on one than two. But I think two is definitely more open to the sort of let's poke a hole in it, you know, strategy that the Sportsman's Alliance has employed before. But yeah, a lot of factors here, and just really interesting debates.
Go ahead, Amy. I want to give Mark a chance to comment on the process too, but go ahead.
Well, I wanted to throw out first a little factoid about Maine political history, which is very relevant to the League of Women Voters, which is that in 1917, there was a referendum for women's suffrage in Maine, which got voted down. So women could have had the right to vote, you know, before the 19th Amendment, but, you know, didn't. And the League of Women Voters, of course, grew out of one of the main women's suffrage organizations. So I want to put that out there. Also, something that Mark knows a great deal about, the progressive era. It's just part of this whole expansion of the role of ordinary people, the direct primary, also making government more professionalized with civil service. So lots of other aspects of the progressive movement that this is the referendum process is part of.
Talk about that, Mark. And I don't know, that made me think also on background, you know, when these referendums come up, like the women's suffrage one, where we ask, let's say, male voters to vote on the rights of women voters, like, is that really fair? But go ahead, Mark.
Well, I think, you know, Mike and Amy, you know, did a good job of pointing out the origins of you know, all of the direct democracy components that we see in the U.S., whether it's referendum or citizens initiative or recall. All of those are in the progressive era, right? The founders were deathly afraid of any elements of direct democracy at all, and they wanted nothing to do with them. And so when we get into the late 19th, early 20th century, and we see a lot of examples of government corruption, and people getting, you know, kind of annoyed that they think that strings are being pulled by elites. one of the things that's put in there is this direct democracy movement. And we start to see, as Mike pointed out, state after state adopting various direct democracy initiatives. Not all states have them, but most do. And they all have their origins in this period of time. The argument in favor of them was that it would allow, as Amy pointed out, the average citizen, the everyday American, to go and make policy changes or recall, you know, officials if they thought that was the right thing to do, but they were being blocked from doing that by elites. So in theory, you know, the whole direct democracy suite sounds like a great idea. Over time, however, a lot of the research on this has shown that increasingly, as they've been used more, as Mike pointed out, they weren't used a lot right off, but they got used more over time. A lot of research shows that these direct democracy components really get taken over by special interests who are able to raise huge amounts of money on one or both sides of the campaign. So really, rather than having, you know, the average citizen have an impact, it's turned into, in many instances, not all by any means, but in many instances, just another way for elites to maybe put their thumb on the scale a little bit more in the policymaking process. So, you know, direct democracy is in theory great. In practice, sometimes has a fair amount of challenges that people don't immediately recognize, but probably would be well served to be aware of.
And you want to mention any of those in particular besides the elite money, or?
Well, I mean, in California, there's lots of examples over time of, you know, people, special interests getting questions on the ballot and then flooding the zone with money to try and get those things done when they couldn't get them done through the legislature. And to me, that's something that people have to at least be aware of, right, as they bake into their evaluation of direct democracy.
Do we have any notable laws in Maine? Anybody want to mention some highlights of reforms that Maine has passed by the initiative process? Mike, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, there are so many, of course. I think the modern example is same-sex marriage, which failed as a referendum 3 years before it passed, right? There's Medicaid expansion. There were individual casinos, right, that were passed by the referendum process because Maine doesn't really have a process other than that to do it. There were two debates, right, over the taxpayer bill of rights, both failed, right, that would have essentially allowed votes on tax increases and spending down to the local level. We've had a lot more that have failed, right, on some pretty big topics, right. In the 80s, there was a referendum on prohibiting pornography, right. Yeah. Not a word I expected to bring up on this show today. But I mean, I think there's nuclear power, right? The referendums over Maine Yankee back then, just massive, massive political debates that came up time and time again.
Go ahead, Amy.
And on voting, clean elections system, public financing system, and also ranked choice voting, which took two times because of the way the legislature dealt with it the first time.
That's right.
Just to piggyback on what Amy said there, it's also worth pointing out that oftentimes the referendum process is not the final word, right, on policy, because oftentimes the legislature can get back involved and clean some things up. And oftentimes, just because something gets on the ballot doesn't necessarily mean that it's constitutional, right? A lot of times things can get on the ballot that are pretty clearly unconstitutional, and then the courts will get involved and do what people thought was going to happen all along. So the voice of the voter is oftentimes not the final word on these matters.
Let me just do a station break and then I'll come back to you, Amy. You're tuned to the Democracy Forum on WERU-FM. This is Ann Luther from the League of Women Voters of Maine. Our guests this afternoon are Mark Brewer, professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of Maine, Amy Fried, professor emerita of political science at the University of Maine, and Michael Shepard, political editor at the Bangor Daily News. This program was pre-recorded on October 17th. No listener calls are being taken now. And we're talking about the history of the citizen initiative process in Maine. And Amy, go ahead.
Yeah, in terms of what voters can put on the ballot in Maine, there's both things that they, you know, groups can come forward, and that's with both question one and question two this time. But we also have the possibility of what we call a people's veto. In other words, to overturn something that has already been put on. And the big example in terms of voting kinds of laws that I would think of is the, I believe it was the 2011 people's veto on same-day voter registration, which had been passed by the legislature and signed by the governor. That was a Republican legislature, both houses Republican, and it was Governor LePage who had been elected in 2010.
So just to be clear, the legislature repealed same-day registration.
And oh, okay. The people's they repealed veto. It.
Then the people's veto reinstated it. Just
okay. But the people's veto was vetoing the legislature. So yes. That's true. The original change was to take something away that already existed. But actually the first marriage vote, the 2009 marriage one was a people's veto, while the 2010 one, in which marriage equality passed, was something that people put on the ballot themselves. So sometimes even the same issue can go through different processes, but they both involve having to collect lots of signatures from voters to put it on the ballot.
Well, speaking of which, Mike, what ballot questions are people likely to encounter if they go to the polls on November 4th? In other words, what petitions are circulating right now?
Yeah, there's not a ton out there. I'd actually have to look up what we've got out there.
Yeah, I'm not aware of any active ones at the moment.
No, they're not massive ones at the very least. I mean, there's always something out there, but very it's kind of rare that they are super well funded.
We had heard that a couple of petitions were submitted, but maybe they haven't been certified for circulation yet.
So I'm not aware of anything that's a big deal at the very least.
Okay, yeah.
If you're going to gather signatures, this is not the time to do that, right? I mean, you want to do it again when there's likely to be high levels of turnout at the polls, because oftentimes you'll see those signature gatherers when you go to cast your ballot, and you're not going to see a heavy turnout this November. Next November, with a congressional cycle, but also in Maine, you'll have a gubernatorial race. Turnout will be much more robust, and so my guess is you'll probably see signature gatherers not only for the November general, but probably in the June primary as well, because it should be pretty high turnout, at least on the Democratic side, for both Senate and governor.
All right, so voting has already started. What should people know about key dates between now and November 4th? Mike?
Well, the big one is that Thursday deadline before the election, which I believe is the 30th this year. Look at your calendar. Don't listen to me. Well, I'm off the top of my head there, but
you're correct.
Okay, great. And so that's the big one. That's the last day to vote in person absentee, which I just did yesterday in Augusta. Great little setup next to where everyone registers their vehicles. So that's the 2 weeks from tomorrow, that's the sort of big deadline. If you want to mail your ballot back to your clerk, I don't think there are going to be big mail delays this year, but do that a week ahead of time, generally speaking, just to make sure everything goes off without a hitch.
Because the ballots are due.
Well, the ballots are due on election day. So you can feel free if you like procrastinating, which I generally don't mind, but you can always bring your ballot back on election day to your clerk, but
a Dropbox. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So early in-person absentee voting is going on now. Some people call it early voting going on now. So people can go down to their clerk's office and either get their ballot, take it home and fill it out and drop it off, or vote it right there in the office and turn it in. That's all happening now.
That's right.
I'd also mention that there is the capacity to look online if you have mailed in your ballot to see that it's been received. At least there was in the past, so I would assume there still is. And that's what I'm planning on doing because I mailed mine yesterday.
Do you have that link right handy, Amy?
Oh, I'd have to look for it.
If you can find it, we'll post it on our website where people can find it. If they're listening to the show, they can look it up afterwards.
Okay.
All right. So final thoughts, question one, question two. We've got a few minutes left. What should people be thinking of as they go into the final weeks of this election on the two questions? Who wants to go first?
I'll take the first stab at question one, I guess. I would just urge people to actually, I don't expect them to read the legislation. That would be ideal. I don't expect people to do that. But the Secretary of State's office has prepared, you know, a very good citizen's guide on both questions. You could read the, if you could only read the summary, I think that would be useful. I think, you know, the Secretary of State's office did a pretty good job with the question of capturing the high points. But as we've all kind of talked about early on, there's a lot more in that legislation that is encompassed in the question, and certainly that is encompassed in the debate surrounding this. So I think if people want to understand, they need to at the very least read the summary, right, that the Secretary of State's office has prepared. And if you're feeling really ambitious, read the legislation so you're prepared to vote on it substantively.
Going to our website for the Democracy Forum at lwvme.org, the link is there to the Citizen's Guide to the Referendum. You can also find that at the Secretary of State's website at maine.gov. Final thoughts on the two questions, Amy?
Well, I certainly agree with Mark. Question one, 85% of it is about absentee balloting. So read the entire question, even though there are other things that are on it. And I guess with question two, there's the consideration to the extent people may want to think about it is how well is the current yellow flag law working?
Mike, on the two questions.
On question one, I would just encourage you to tune out the campaigns and who are kind of each focusing on both part, but one each side of this, right, and sort of weigh the impact of voter ID and the absentee ballot changes and how that comports with your views on voting, right? And on question two, I would dig into literature on the yellow flag law. There are reports out there about how it was used before Lewiston, how it's been used after Lewiston. You know, lots of good reporting out there on that.
Are there links that we should share on that?
I will definitely get those to you.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Absolutely. And I think that one is, it's a little bit less loud of a campaign, but you know, do you think it's working better or worse? And I think you could figure that out for yourselves.
All right, great. Well, we've got a few minutes left, and I sort of want to ask you all a very leading question as we sort of wrap up the show, because this is a show about civic participation, and we talk a little bit about political philosophy, but we also talk about the reality of the current moment. So as we think about Maine citizen participation in the referendum era, in the Trump era, you know, what are your final thoughts about the election coming up and what people should keep in mind as they get ready to vote this year? Mark?
Well, I think, you know, I've lived in Maine now for a little over 20 years, and Maine has always struck me as a highly participatory civic community. I don't think that's changed since I've been here. We're regularly in the top five, often tops in the country in terms of voter turnout. We still have a direct democracy component we haven't talked about today with New England Town Meeting. You know, there is a high level of participatory civic culture in Maine. That being said, one change I've noticed in that 20 plus years is that our politics have become much more polarized in Maine than they were when I first got here. Now, maybe not quite as polarized as we are at the national level, but not as civil as they used to be. And that concerns me. I mean, polarization in and of itself isn't necessarily a bad thing because people differ in terms of substance, and that's fine. But we need to conduct ourselves civilly in the discussion of that difference. And I think that's what we're losing nationally. And I worry we're losing that in Maine increasingly. And that concerns me. It's not the disagreement. It's our inability or our unwillingness to do that civilly, which I think is a concern.
Amy, final thoughts, wax philosophical for us.
Well, I would agree with Mark on that, but I think Maine voters are highly pragmatic at the same time. So even though there's a lot of polarization and divide, and you know, conspiracy theories can sometimes find attachments, I think most Maine voters look at what's going to work, what's going to work for them. And they mostly respect each other, you know, not everyone, to be sure. But I think compared to a lot of the country, we're much better off. And we do have a lot to be proud of when it comes to our voting system and the high rates of voter participation.
Great. Mike, last word for you.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with all that. And every election season does kind of make me proud in Maine that I think a lot of times, you know, voters sniff out, right, a lot of the sort of arguments. And I think that we should give them great credit because you generally can't argue with the voters' decision. But I think generally speaking, right, voters do make the right decision. So I think that trusting this great tradition of participation that we have, this idea that our elections, right, are so distributed that every little town is making their own series of little decisions, and they make them for such different reasons. I think Mark is right too. Polarization is an issue. I mean, the first and second congressional district really don't look anything like each other anymore, and they're going in two different directions. And you see the legislature sort of reflecting that now, where Democrats can't win in rural areas and Republicans can't win anywhere vaguely resembling a city for the most part. So I think that the risk there is that we can't talk to each other, right, as much as we have been able to in the past, and places just don't look, they look a lot different. And I think that long term, right, that's an issue for me.
Yeah. Thank you all three so much. We're out of time. This afternoon, that's our show for today. Thank you to our guests this afternoon, Mark Brewer, professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of Maine, Amy Fried, professor emerita of political science at the University of Maine, and Michael Shepard, political editor at the Bangor Daily News. You've been listening to the Democracy Forum, a project of the League of Women Voters Down East, produced in cooperation with WERU-FM. We're streaming at weru.org. If you have a comment about this show, send it to news@weru.org. Please put Democracy Forum in the subject line. The League's website is at lwvme.org. You'll find there more information about this topic, some of the links we've mentioned on the show, and you can learn about other shows in this series. You can subscribe to our podcast also at lwvme.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you here next month.